Good evening. Our topic tonight is the schism of Hungarian Jewry in 1869. Yes. A lot of good Greek words. Well, Hungarian Jewry, which numbered about 500,000 people around that time, was horribly divided as a result, ironically, of an attempt to unify it. An attempt that was made by the government with the encouragement of one side of the religious aisle and much to the horror and dismay of the other side of the religious aisle. And ultimately, that attempt at unity was foiled, and instead you had the development of institutional structure for disparate strands of Judaism. Actually, not just two strands of Judaism, but even three, as it would eventually emerge. But let's look at the background a little bit. Non-Orthodox Judaism in Hungary was called Neologue Judaism. And as I mentioned in past weeks, it was not an ideologically sophisticated or a theologically impressive strand of Judaism. Unlike Reform in Germany, which had deep thinkers, as heretical as they might have been, and as religiously abhorrent as they might have been from a traditional point of view, they were deep thinkers. And they had reasons for doing away with aspects of the tradition that they felt were no longer for their era. But in Hungary, that wasn't the case. The move away from tradition was largely, or almost exclusively, in the realm of synagogue behavior, architecture of the synagogue, a little bit the liturgy, the aesthetics, the attire of the clergy, the use of the choir, the music, making the synagogue experience a more modern churchy experience. But what was totally missing from the Neologue strand of Judaism was an attempt to declare that various aspects of the halakha are null and void, that need not be observed in modern times. That is completely missing. Most of the changes were the result of the insistence of the laity for these synagogal lowercase r reforms. And the rabbis who acquiesced did so either because they were not fundamentalist or extremist traditionalists, but rather moderate types, or because they had no choice. Their congregants were saying, this is what's going to happen, and we're going to do it over your objections. Very rarely did you have a synagogue reform of any kind that was initiated by the clergy, almost always by the lay people. So there's nothing so terrible in the eyes of a strict construction of the halakha with certain of these synagogue reforms. They don't actually break the rules. They may break the tradition, but they don't break the official rules. So why then would the traditionalists get all worked up about these kinds of changes, the likes of which were adopted by Orthodox rabbis in Germany? Samson Raphael Hirsch's canonicals and choir and German language sermon would have been regarded basically as Neologue Judaism by the standards of Hungary at the same time. And yet, clearly he was an Orthodox rabbi and was siding with the Orthodox in the Hungarian fight. So there are different frames of reference in Hungary as opposed to Germany. The rabbis of the Neologue movement do their best to justify whatever changes happen within the strict letter of the halakha, claiming we haven't broken the rules. We haven't broken the rules. And we're just doing things to make the people happy within the rules. Now, the Neologue movement is similar to the positive historical movement of the Breslau Seminary, but they're not exactly the same. Breslau and Zacharia Frankel were great scholars devoted to the Wissenschaft des Judentum, the scientific study of Judaism, who justified their departure from tradition on scholarly grounds. The Neologue don't need scholarly grounds to justify their departures from tradition. They're just doing it. And they're saying it's not so terrible. Not so terrible. Yeah.
I mean, the typical neologue in that time, when they built the Dohani synagogue, were they all eating kosher?
That's the good question. How frum were these people? Put the rabbis aside, the laity. The answer is that the economic and social integration of progressive Jews in Hungary advanced very rapidly between 1840 and 1867, so that these Jews no longer had the ability to observe the mitzvot in the traditional fashion because of real-world obstacles to Sabbath observance, to kashrus observance. And so, what do you do when there is a gap between the theoretically appropriate religion and the practically observable religion? You make the gap a whole lot smaller by doing what?
Capitulating.
By capitulating on the theory, not on the practice. In other words, you're already departing from the tradition, so we're going to make that kosher by saying that what? No, not like the reformers of Germany, that you're allowed to eat treif. No. But rather, that just because you ate treif doesn't make you a bad Jew, and doesn't make you any less of a participant in communal life. So the chidush, the novelty of Neologue Judaism, was not to say that averot are permitted, but rather that the Baal Avera, the person who is the sinner, really isn't much of a sinner anyway, because we don't worry about private observance.
So how do the rabbis reconcile with that?
They don't. This becomes an ongoing feature of Neologue Judaism for the next three generations, where on the books, religion is still a traditional one, yet in fact, people don't observe.
What do you mean by, let's say, the facts and the circumstances do not allow them to keep their...
In other words, market day was Saturday, schools open on Saturday, holidays... So in Germany you had the same thing. However, in Germany there is this sincere desire on the part of the progressive to officially renounce the binding character of the traditional law. Whereas in Hungary there really is no desire to do that. There's just the reality that we're having difficulty observing, and the generation after the difficulty in observance manifests itself, the next generation really isn't all that interested in observance. They're not actively hostile to the tradition, it's just that it's not much of a part of their life anymore, and so they're looking for a style of Judaism that is a high church synagogue, and one which is not going to bust their chops over the fact that privately they don't keep kosher. And that is Neologue Judaism.
But the Orthodox in Hungary, what was their beef? Was their beef against the synagogue layout, or was the beef against the congregants?
Okay, so that's a good question, and it depends upon the decade. Early on, the thinking was that the non-observant are a mumar lahakis, a person rebelling against Judaism to spite the tradition, or maybe even l'tayavon, because they have their appetite requires that they work on the Sabbath to make a living. But they're a mumar. They're doing wrong, not just the clergy, but even the private citizen who isn't observant anymore. Later, that is no longer true, but rather the laity are seen as sort of a tinok shenishba, a captive child who doesn't know any better, and only a handful of the Neologue clergy are seen as apikorsim, heretics. Okay. So, this movement is afoot.
No.
Not really. Not much of anything.
They may have just skipped things.
They might have skipped things here and there in certain of the more radical congregations. Okay. So in the 1860s, you have the Hungarians take over their own country. In 1848, there was a revolution. And that revolution failed. And throughout the 1850s, the Habsburg monarch, the Austrian monarch, ruled with an iron fist over Hungary through his appointed representatives throughout the kingdom. But that absolutist rule was collapsing in the 1860s, and the Magyar nationality was emerging as the dominant ethnic group in the Kingdom of Hungary, and they wanted to control their own affairs. An agreement was reached in 1867 basically giving the Hungarians autonomy over their own country, in which there'd be a lower house of parliament that was popularly elected. There'd also be an upper house of parliament, which was like a nobility, and then there'd be the king, who's a rubber stamp. So the Habsburg monarch is no longer the boss, he's just the rubber stamp of what the lower house of the Hungarian legislature is going to do. And what is that parliament going to do? Emancipate the Jews, finally and completely. But with the emancipation of the Jews, you have a real big question. What is the status of Judaism? It's one thing to say that Jews are now full citizens. It's quite another thing to say that Judaism as a religion is on par with the other religions of the realm. They don't want that. That's too radical. Now, one way of saying it's on par with the other religions is to say that we'll give them, you know, the same special status that we accord to the Catholic Church and the Protestant denominations, or the Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox denominations. Another is to say, let's be like America and have a separation of church and state. Well, almost nobody was saying that. That is too extreme for mid-19th century Europe. That may work fine in America, but it can't work just yet in Hungary, where the churches still function in governmental ways. Like what? Marriage, registration of births and deaths, collection of taxes for the purpose of supplying religious institutions. I mean, in a variety of ways, the church is still part of the government.
How was education?
Education is under the auspices of the church. So you need a Jewish church. And since you need a Jewish church, then you need to have the Jews cooperate with the government in establishing the parameters of that Jewish church. Yeah. The Satmar are involved, although the Teitelbaum family is still not yet in Satmar, they're in Siget early on. And they represent, we're going to get to soon, the faction of the erratic Sephardim. You could call the Satmar erratic Sephardim. That doesn't make any sense, right? That's a term that makes no sense. Okay. So, one, they're erratic in the sense that they're unreliable politically. Even as we see the emergence of Orthodox institutions, you can't trust them.
Nothing's changed.
Okay, and secondly, they're Sephardim in contrast to Ashkenazim. They daven Nusach Sephard, and so they identify as the beleaguered Sephardim in contrast to the Ashkenazim who are persecuting them for their beliefs. It's a real big struggle between so-called Ashkenazim and Sephardim in the Interland and in Transylvania. So, we'll get to them eventually.
Did the Jews who were working with the government,
yeah,
were those the wealthy ones?
Okay, yes. Okay. So, in February of 1867, the wealthy Budapest assimilated type Jews are the ones to first approach the nascent government of the Kingdom of Hungary about the creation of a Jewish national organization that would regulate the congregations and would regulate relations between the congregations and would determine matters of matrimonial issues and educational issues for all the Jews of Hungary. Well, if you're an Orthodox person, whether in the backward Unterland or the more enlightened Oberland or even in Budapest, are you going to be very happy that these Ignatzes of the world who go to the Dohani Temple are going to boss you around in terms of what the rules are of the Jewish community? No, it looks a little dangerous, a little suspicious. And so the Orthodox worry about what's going to happen next. Emancipation is announced in December of 1867, and the key government minister with a supervisory role over religion is Josef Otvos. He is the minister of religion and education. So right up the alley of the Jews. He would like to create this national organization of the Jews that would have the bylaws for the congregations and figure out all the details that the government needs to know about now that the Jews are emancipated. Now, by the way, even though the Jews are emancipated, because there's no separation of church and state, and because the country is a Christian country by nature, Judaism remains only an accepted, or rather acknowledged, religion.
Tolerated.
But not fully accepted. It's acknowledged but not accepted, which means that a Gentile cannot become a Jew, but a Jew could become a Gentile. A person could convert from the Eastern Orthodox Church to become a Catholic, and vice versa, and a Jew could become a Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox, but a Gentile of any persuasion, Christian persuasion, could not become a Jew. And intermarriage was illegal.
St.
Mary. St.
Mary,
yeah. So, now, what is the attitude of the Jewish community of Hungary towards this second-tier status for Judaism? Are they okay with it?
I wouldn't be.
Okay, there's a machlokus. The progressives feel this is an affront to Jewish pride. After all, if we're escaping the Middle Ages and moving into the modern period, and the state is going to emancipate Jewry and make the Jewish people as individual citizens of the state, who now have a relationship with the centralized government, well then, their religion should not be a second-tier religion, but rather all religions should be equal. There may not be a separation of church and state, but at least the Jewish religion should be on par with the Christian denominations. That's the progressive point of view. However, what is the fundamentalist Orthodox point of view? It's better this way. Why? Because who wants to allow for intermarriage? You see, half the Jewish population is now neolog. They're not keeping kosher, Shabbos, and the like. The next thing that's going to happen is someone's going to marry a shiksa. So at least if the laws of the country don't allow for it, it's a bulwark against the worst facets of assimilation. So you can understand why there's this machlokus about the status of Judaism. Ultimately what happens, in 1895, finally Judaism is given accepted status on par with the Christian denominations. Yeah.
You said beforehand that they would come up with a bylaws for all the
shul. Yeah.
Isn't that a minefield that,
Correct. It's something that's best done at the local level, not at the national level. But the desire was, at least in theory, to have a formula that would work in all congregations.
Yeah, but we're Jews. We would come up with an angle anyway.
Okay, and it didn't last long. Okay. So, what... Yeah. So the emancipation was worded in the negative, not in the positive, that a person's civil and political rights shall not be infringed upon by virtue of their religious persuasion, which is different from the Jews are hereby emancipated. Like in France, the Jews were emancipated, first in 1790 for the Sephardim and in 1791 for the Ashkenazim of Alsace-Lorraine. But it was an affirmative emancipation of the Jews. Whereas in Hungary in 1867, it's by formulating it in the negative, it doesn't say anything about Jews per se or Judaism. It just is a cute way of acknowledging that the Jew individually is no longer a second-class citizen.
There was a different angle there. The Hungarian government did not disavow the Hungarian Christian Church.
No.
Whereas in France...
Yes, it was anti-clerical. It was anti-clerical. Well, not forever, because in 1808 Napoleon brings back a certain clericalism and an attitude towards the Jews which isn't so hospitable. But at least for two decades, you're right. Yeah.
Was there any discussion or gathering amongst the Jews in these different European countries?
Okay.
Ways that they might be able to push this movement?
Yes. Okay. Yes, absolutely. And with different degrees of success. In Hungary, there were various gatherings throughout the 1860s, and it worked. I mean, it was going to happen anyway. I don't think that the political machinations of the progressive Budapest Jews really made all that much of a difference. I think it was a foregone conclusion that as the state moved in a liberal direction, the Jews were going to be emancipated. Oh, no. So the answer to that is no. The Alliance Israelite, which is established in 1860, is a French operation which has offices around the world.
It's philanthropic.
It's philanthropic in nature. It's not really about emancipation. Each country had its own story you don't have a pan-world Jewish organization looking for emancipation. By the time you have such organizations, the Western Jews are already free. Yeah.
So, emancipation, does that mean that the highest level of emancipation is...
You can run for office. A Gentile, correct. That you could run for public office and hold that office.
Now, was that part of this emancipation?
Yes, yes,
so
yes. And they, in fact, there were member. There was a Jewish member of parliament about whom we will speak tonight because he says something inappropriate that got himself into trouble vis-a-vis the Jewish religious issues.
It also meant that Jews could serve
in
the army.
Well, Jews were already serving in the army since the days of the Edict of Tolerance in Joseph II in the 1780s, whether they wanted to or not.
Oh, so that wasn't part of the emancipation.
No, that was already an element in Austria-Hungary from the 1780s. Okay. Yes, the Noda Yehuda, the chief rabbi of Prague, had to bless the event of the conscription of the first Jewish soldiers. With tears running down his eyes, he did his duty to the state. Okay, now, yeah.
And they were kidnapping these boys.
Well, that's in Russia. That's
Russia.
Not there.
Russia.
Yeah.
They have the laws. What about the people themselves?
Uh-huh.
Did they accept Jews as, we'll say, equals, or they were still...
Well, Hungarian anti-Semitism always existed. It wasn't as virulent as Nazi Germany, but you have the arrow crossed during the Second World War, which is pretty bad. Individually, yes, but I'm saying as a political entity, Hungary never was as bad. They had numerous clauses in the 1930s. But we're talking about a period of time...
Horthy was not tzaddik,
understood. But in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, we're not dealing with blatant, politically motivated anti-Semitism. Okay, so let's get back to the religion issue. You have a call for a Jewish Congress, a Hungarian Jewish National Congress, which would be of elected deputies who would determine the bylaws of the Jewish National Organization. Well, 220 deputies are going to be elected by the various congregations. What percentage are going to be Orthodox? What percentage are going to be Neolog? To be honest, it would be impossible to know ahead of time because... Number one, there's the issue of how many delegates does each congregation get. Do the larger ones get more than the smaller ones? Of course. There's going to be a certain demographic factor involved. But even when somebody is elected, who's to say you know really where they stand on any given issue? He could be a liberal Orthodox or he could be a conservative Neolog. And when you get to the meeting house, then it's going to be up to the delegates to figure out what club they join. And when I say club, I mean in the 19th century political sense of the word club, which is like a caucus in modern American political parlance. You know, the Democratic caucus, the Republican caucus. You're going to have to side with one group, not because you vote with them on every issue, but because, generally speaking, that's your persuasion. Ultimately, what happens is that of the 220 members, about 117 were Neolog. About 90 were Orthodox, and the rest were somewhere in the middle. So there's a good, strong, working majority of Neolog representatives. But even before the Congress happens, there's a gathering of rabbis in Budapest, traditional rabbis who want to formulate the Orthodox strategy towards this upcoming disaster of a Congress. And of course, the rabbis of the Orthodox branch are themselves not of one opinion. Last week we discussed how there are the extremists who want no accommodations to modernity whatsoever, who have outlawed secular learning and the Hungarian or German sermons in the synagogue, basically are just irredentists of the worst kind.
They're not Hasidim.
Some of them are Hasidim, but some of them are non-Hasidim. Then you have neo-Orthodox types like Hildesheimer, who culturally are basically the same as the Neologs, but in terms of religious observance are fervently Orthodox. And then you have the centrists, who are the dominant faction, represented by the biggest of the rabbis, like the Ketav Sofer, like Yirmiyahu Lo, like the Maharam Shik, the most important of them all. So what is their strategy? They know they're in the minority. What are they going to do? So one thing that they do is to say that on matters of religion, the majority cannot rule. That on matters of administration and bureaucracy, we acknowledge that the majority can rule. But on matters of pure religion, you have to respect the conscience of the individual, and the majority cannot coerce the minority to do anything. The promise from the minister of the government was that this Congress was not going to address specifically religious issues. It was only going to be a matter of administration and bureaucracy. But where is the international border between religion and bureaucracy? There is none. It's wherever you want to draw it.
So where you want to do a budget, you're going to have a budget that's going to favor one group over another.
Okay, so give me a bullet point that might be to the Orthodox a matter of religion, but might be to the Neologue a matter of bureaucracy.
Education.
Marriage.
So of the various answers, all of them are good, but actually mikveh might be the best one. What? Why mikveh? You could have said Eruv. You could have said Shochtim also. Basically, any religious function that requires halachic supervision and is important for a community to function as an orderly Jewish community of religious people, so you're going to need to do what? Pay for it. But if you have a community that isn't especially frum, then they might simply not include that in the budget or their list of priorities. So it's not that they've abolished Shechita, or abolished the mikveh, or abolished the Eruv. It just wasn't important to them, so they didn't bother funding it. Or they didn't talk about it.
It usually comes up with this as a modern thing, is money also dictates the terms of using it and requirements.
Right, so with mikveh you have that when the non-Orthodox paid for it, can they then use it for various purposes, including conversion. In America in the late 20th century, that was a big machlokes, especially in Great Neck, I remember, in my youth. Okay, so that's one issue. Another issue is, what should be the Orthodox policy on education? The Neologue are in favor of Jewish public schools funded by the Kehillah. But the Orthodox tend to be against that. They rather would have the cheder. Now, the fundamentalists want only the cheder and nothing else. Of course, that's going to be against the law because there's going to be compulsory secular education. So if you have compulsory secular education, but you want the cheder, then where are you going to get your secular education? In a non-Jewish school. And why is a non-Jewish school preferable to a Jewish school? Because in the Jewish school, the teacher is going to be an apikoris. They're going to learn heresy. Whereas from the Shegetz teacher in the public school, they'll just learn math, and then they'll go back to the cheder to learn Gemara.
And,
so,
and about Jesus?
Even if there's no Jesus. There's no. Don't worry about Jesus.
Oh, I'm not? Okay.
Don't worry about Jesus. Even if they mention him, everybody's going to know that's for the other guys, not for our team. So for all these reasons, from the more fundamentalist Orthodox point of view, the non-Jewish school was to be preferred over the Jewish day school, especially if the community was dominated by a Neologue.
Let me say, in other words, if you have a math teacher in a day school, that's more threatening than a math teacher.
If you have a Jewish math teacher in a Jewish school run by the Neologues, and the guy's not wearing a yarmulke and didn't make a bracha when he eats his treif sandwich at lunchtime, that's a bad influence on the children who would pay us. So better they should see a goy who puts 4 plus 4 equals 8, and then they leave and they learn Talmud with the Rebbe. Okay. So what the other big issue on the issue of education was the seminary. Now, we spoke about the seminary last time. The educational fund, which was based upon money that was extracted from the Jewish coffers, it was a fine levied on the Jewish community for their participation in the Revolution of 1848, was still available to be used. The government wants to have a seminary because the government wants to train progressive rabbis. So, what are you going to do about it? Again, in 1864, Hildesheimer was in favor of an Orthodox seminary, and the centrists and the fundamentalists were against it. The same machlokas happens now, with the issue being basically unchanged. The Neolog, if you let them grab hold of the money, are going to create a non-Orthodox rabbinical seminary, which ultimately happens. In 1877, it's finally established, the Jewish University of Budapest, which functioned until the 1930s and produced Neolog rabbis. It was...
They actually called themselves a university?
Yeah.
That must have been the first one in the world.
I don't know if it was the first one to use the term university, but it probably was. Probably was.
Well, you didn't become university until after World War II.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
When you say university, the definition of university is you have more than one campus. They have more than one campus.
No, they had one building on a street in Budapest.
So it's a college.
Okay.
University means you have a graduate program.
Graduate program, yeah. Okay, so the Congress happens. They gather December of 1868 through February of 1869. And right off the bat, there's a problem. Who's the president of the Congress? So the Orthodox, they know that they're not going to win the presidency because the majority is Neolog. They're ready to give that up. But within the Neolog, you have further to the left and further to the right. So if you could get a centrist who's not a Fabrenta Neolog, that would be better than someone who's a hard leftist. And they end up losing on that point. Dr. Ignaz Hirschler becomes the president of the Congress. Then, who are the two vice presidents of the Congress? So typically, what do you do when you have a split house? You make a member of the minority the first vice president or the second vice president. And yet somehow the Orthodox fouled this up and didn't get anything. And on the whole, as a parliamentary matter, the Orthodox did not have any measure of success. Everything was against them because they did not have enough seats. Speaking of seats and the sides of the aisle in which they sat, the Neolog sat on the right side and the Orthodox sat on the left side, and everyone joked they're on the wrong side. So, also, the Neolog representatives dressed like Magyar nobility for the occasion. There was a certain pomp and circumstance. There was a ceremonial flavor to the whole thing, like it really was a Jewish parliament. And the acculturated Jews dressed as though they were part of the Hungarian parliament. The Orthodox are not doing well, and they come up with a new idea. This idea is that the Congress has to acknowledge that Judaism as a religion, is as defined by the Talmud and Shulchan Aruch. Is that going to pass muster with the Neolog? No. So why do it? In order to convince the authorities that traditional Judaism is not being represented in this august body. And therefore, the Orthodox were right in criticizing the whole enterprise and in claiming that the gap between Neolog and Orthodox was as wide as between the Catholics and the Protestants. And therefore, just as a Catholic is not coerced to participate in the same supra-communal structure as the Protestants, so too neither should the Orthodox be coerced to be with the Neologs.
This is a setup for a boycott.
So this is a setup for a boycott. Now, the question is, who's going to walk out, and is the walkout identified by those who remain as just, you know, sour grapes and people leaving their post because they're unhappy, or is it understood to mean an absolute fissure, complete break? So the Neolog who stayed behind simply said, well, these guys are not here to vote, so we'll vote without them. It's not as though they have resigned. They've just absented themselves for the day or for the week or for the month. And so they just don't get to vote. Well, how many left? So of the 88 who signed the document about the Shulchan Aruch, 48 of them left, leaving behind Hildesheimer's rump Orthodox group, which was mostly a neo-Orthodox, because he figured it's better to stay than to leave. Maybe we'll accomplish something. Maybe in certain areas of communal life we could find common ground with the other side of the aisle. And he wasn't entirely wrong. There were areas where the Neolog were interested in preserving tradition. But because he stayed behind when others left, that made him appear to be something of like a Benedict Arnold to the Orthodox cause. And as a result, he couldn't stick around in Hungary. Not that he really wanted to stick around in Hungary. He left and went to Berlin just a few months later to become the rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, and then later found the Berlin Seminary. So that's the fate of the Congress itself. The statutes were promulgated by the Neolog majority, and they were going to be ratified by the king. So the Orthodox figure, what do we have to do now? We have to petition the king, Franz Josef, to not sign off on these protocols on the grounds that he is a good man, an enlightened monarch, who will not want to have religious coercion under his authority. So nothing of a religious nature was taken into account. This is all bureaucratic, but a bureaucracy for individual communities that then might be led by Neolog Jews who dismiss the interests of the Orthodox. The Orthodox are very worried about this, so they go to the king. They get an audience with the king in his royal palace in Budapest, not in Vienna, in Budapest, in the middle of 1869, and he disappoints them and doesn't tear up the results of the Congress. He signs off on them. But to be honest, the Orthodox should have known better and should have realized this was a fool's errand, because unlike 1864, when the Orthodox rabbis petitioned the king to nullify the seminary project, and he did, in 1869, the King of Hungary is not really the King of Hungary. King of Hungary is just some guy who wears a crown on his head. He is not the autocrat anymore. It's a parliamentary democracy with a rubber stamp monarchy. And the rubber stamp stamped, okay? There was very little he could do to stop the wishes of the government and of the majority of the Jewish delegates. So, all right, the Jews are very, very sad. They're very nervous. What do we do now? Well, the next thing was, the communities had to elect local boards according to the statutes, the bylaws established by the Congress. So the Orthodox propaganda machine went hard at work. Now, the Orthodox propaganda machine was called Shomrei Hadat, or Shomrei Hadas, which means guardians of the faith, of the religion. That's the funeral home. So Shomrei Hadas was nominally under the auspices of the big centrist rabbis, but Lamaisa, really, it was run by neo-Orthodox lay people, Sigmund Krauss being the most important one. And they had publications, they had a weekly newspaper, they knew how to rally the troops. So they spread a lie. What was the lie? The lie was that if you don't bother to elect a board based upon the bylaws of the Congress, that was a passive way of indicating your non-acceptance of Congress or Neolog Judaism, and that you are a separate religion or a separate type of kehillah, that you're not bound by these rules unless you choose to be bound by these rules. That wasn't really true. The government, at least the Minister of Religion and Education, claimed that all Jews, regardless of the level of their piety and their political persuasion, were bound by the decisions of the Congress. And no matter how much they tried to obfuscate the issue, they're bound by the rules. So that tactic, you know, worked briefly but didn't work long run. The next thing was to get the parliament to undo the decisions of the Congress and of the Minister of Religion. Because after all, the parliament never approved any of this stuff. The Minister of Religion took it upon himself. He arrogated to himself authority that maybe he didn't have under the law, under the constitution of the Kingdom of Hungary. So, in 1870, you have a debate in the Hungarian parliament over whether or not the Orthodox Jews are to be compelled to participate in the Congress-style Jewish administration. there's one Jewish member of parliament, and he says, I'm in a unique position to tell you about what's going on, because I was also a delegate to the Jewish Congress a year and a half earlier. And let me tell you that the Orthodox are a bunch of fundamentalist crazies, and they're against Magyar nationalism, and we, the progressive neo-log Jews, are the good guys, and we're in favor of the Kingdom of Hungary, so you should coerce the Orthodox to do exactly what we're doing. And don't let them have their independence, their autonomy. To which certain Gentile deputies in the parliament said, a chutzpah of you to speak that way about your co-religionists. They're just as patriotic Hungarian citizens as you are. Don't badmouth them. And in fact, it's a matter of freedom of religion, and we're not going to compel them to do what they don't want to do. So it boomeranged on them. They tried to bite off more than they could chew. And on Shushan Purim, a Purim miracle, Shushan Purim, March 18th, 1870, it was determined that the Orthodox do not have to participate in the supracommunal organization created by the Congress, but rather they are free to create their own organization. Okay.
This sounds unheard of, because if you're a Roman Catholic,
yeah,
or you're a Jesuit,
yeah,
or you're a different group, they're not going to go ahead and separate you. And here I would think that if you are not Jewish,
yeah,
you say, Jews are Jews. I mean,
okay, so for a long time that was the conventional Gentile thinking. And to be honest, it was a conventional Jewish thinking too. But with enough persuasion and political pressure and arm twisting and propaganda by the Orthodox, they were able to convince Gentile members of the legislature that there really is this gap between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox, and that as a matter of religious freedom, it would be wrong, morally wrong and constitutionally wrong, to coerce people to do what they don't want to do. Now, to be honest, there really wasn't that much of a difference between the Orthodox and the Neolog. I mean, yes, the average chassid is a whole lot more observant than the average member of the Dohani temple. But it's not like it was in Germany. It's not as though the Neolog rabbis were saying that treif is permitted. But who's to say what is too wide of a gap to try to overcome? To what might seem to me to be a...
You skirted it before.
Yeah.
Was there any issue of corruption that maybe some people among the Gentile parliamentarians were getting something to give the Orthodox or the full community a little bit extra?
I would not doubt that that happened, but I don't have any evidence of it.
Because that's the ethos here. I mean, haven't worked. You know,
I understand. You were in the 718 area code,
exactly.
I know.
This was that mentality, yeah. Hungarian, coming in and setting the chessboard up in their favor.
It probably did happen. I just have no proof of it. Okay.
Who funded the Jewish community?
The Jews. They paid taxes.
Oh, okay. So therefore, if you had two groups,
yeah,
they would have to be self-sufficient,
yes,
in themselves.
Okay, so now let's see what happens.
In Germany,
yeah.
Samson Raphael Hirsch, I mean, he was funded by the Kehila, which was not religious.
So Samson Raphael Hirsch was a very savvy operator. He was able to raise money from wealthy Jews in Frankfurt who were not necessarily all that observant, but who subscribed to his way of thinking when it came to matters of the congregation. And they supported the IRG very lavishly. If he had to rely upon people who were absolutely shomer mitzvos, he probably never would have been able to fund the aspects of his congregational life that he was able to pull off.
Right, but he was funded by the overall,
yeah,
group.
Not in the beginning.
Later
on, after 1876. But not in the beginning. Okay, yeah.
You would also think that one of the reasons the Orthodox community wanted to disassociate from the others is the concern of the slippery slope problem, not knowing where that direction
was. Okay, so I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the arguments that the Neologs had in favor of one supracommunal structure and rejecting the notion of two is that they were saying, we are fairly traditional Jews, and don't worry about slippery slope, because radical reform has no place in Hungary. It was tried very briefly in 1848 with Ignaz Einhorn and Sunday Sabbath, and he was a disciple of Samuel Holdheim, the most radical of the German rabbis, but that it was suppressed, it never had a large following, and it isn't coming back. Therefore, you need not worry about very non-traditional Judaism emerging in this country. It isn't going to happen. And he was right. Or rather, they were right in making that assertion. Radical reform never found a place in Hungary.
How long did this Congress hang around?
It was in session from December 10th through late February.
But the laws, how long did
they... Until the Holocaust. Yeah. Okay, so now, what happened to the Orthodox group? So the Orthodox, in 1870, begin the effort to establish their own national organization, and its bylaws are finally authorized by the government, approved by the government in 1871, about a year and a half later. And so now, kihilot that are predominantly Orthodox are able to sign up with this national body. But they're having a hard time getting people to join. Why? Because even in places where there's a significant percentage of religious Jews, still there's going to be a percentage of neologue or middle-of-the-roaders. And so it's a struggle to sign them up, just as Shamshon Raphael Hirsch would have struggled to get members of his own shul to secede from the official kehillah. So what? How do you bolster the chances of kihilot with a strong Orthodox element joining the Orthodox national body by having the gedolim announce that if you don't, you're going to go to hell?
That'll do it.
Okay, so what happens? The Maram Shik basically issues an announcement, a psak, and he's not the only one, others did it too, that you have an achrayus of a responsibility to join with the Orthodox national organization. Lo tamor adam reyecha, don't stand idly by while your neighbor's blood is shed. You know, you have a responsibility to your fellow that you have to show, lead by example and join our organization. Well, who won't join? Hasidim, a lot of them will not join. Why? Because it's against the tradition. Our fathers and our grandfathers didn't belong to a so-called Orthodox National Hungarian Jewish organization. So therefore, since they didn't do it, we're not going to do it. Now, of course, circumstances were entirely different the generation or two earlier, and now maybe it was necessary. But when you treat tradition, or rather precedent, as absolute, and you throw logic and everything else out, then maybe that's going to be your attitude. Alternatively, what happens in a community where it's roughly a 50-50 split, and you don't get a consensus among the householders as to what to do? Or it's a community where there were moderate reforms of the synagogue that happened before the Congress, and so this community really wouldn't fit well in the Orthodox, but it also doesn't really want to go to the neologue. So because there are different considerations in play all around the country, some don't join either group. They rather become status quo. So status quo is a term that first emerges in late 1871 to describe these kind of neither here nor there communities. So they're independent, but interestingly, in 1926, well after the era we're talking about now, they establish a status quo national organization, a third national body of these independents who couldn't figure out their place in either the Orthodox or the Neologue.
It took them a long time.
Well, they only did it because there was money involved. There was government funding for national bodies, so therefore they had to joined together for some purpose. So there's Neologue, there's Orthodox, and there's status quo. But status quo does not necessarily mean middle of the road between Orthodox and Neologue. It can mean that, but it could also mean guys who couldn't make up their mind because you had a mixed community of people with firm opinions on both sides, or people who just were not team players. They didn't want to join anyone because they didn't want to commit.
How significant were they in numbers?
About 12%. About 45% were Neologue, 45% were Orthodox, about 12%, 10%, 12% were status quo in the beginning, but later it would change. On the eve of World War II, it was two-thirds Neolog, one-third Orthodox.
Where was Hasidim?
So it depends. Some Hasidim were Orthodox, and some Hasidim were status quo. Each community did its own thing. One of the big reasons why some Hasidim remained status quo and not Orthodox was because the biggest enemy of the Hasidim was Rabbi Yirmiyahu Lov, Jeremiah Lov, and he was seen as the Ashkenazi centrist Orthodox, so therefore the Hasidim have to do otherwise. No, Neolog, Neo-Orthodox, Centrist-Orthodox, Ultra-Orthodox.
That's how it goes.
That's how it goes, yeah. That's my story, I'm sticking to it. Yeah.
So the status quo people didn't have to pay dues?
So the status quo people did not pay to support a national infrastructure, but they had to pay for their own kehilah. They had to pay the rabbi, the shochet, the moral, and all that. Now, you had a question.
Rabbi Lo, is he a descendant of the Maharal?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think so, but I don't know for sure.
He wasn't into movies or anything like that.
The Austrians are not involved. The Austrians are the paradigmatic example for the Neolog community, meaning Vienna, the Vienna Rite. Isaac Noah Mannheimer, the cathedral synagogue with the fancy chazan, with the church-like music, that is what Neolog Judaism was imitating. Okay, but they have no relationship to this fight here.
They're not saying that the Austrian regular Jew, plain Jew, is more Orthodox than the general population in Hungary.
No, there were the in Vienna and in the core lands of the Austrian the Habsburg Empire. The Jewish life was deteriorating fairly rapidly.
There were not that many Jews.
And there were almost no really religious Jews.
In Austria.
Right.
Well,
later on, you have people who move there, but they move there from Hungary, from Galicia, that's after World War I, maybe even a little before, but the point is not in the 1860s.
Between the World Wars,
primarily. So Galicia is supplying the population for the Unterland, for the fundamentalist Orthodox of northeast Hungary, because they move across the border when Galicia is absorbed into the Habsburg Empire. And that's the Hasidic influence is coming from Galicia. Okay. The status quo fellows have a problem, big problem. Because they're not officially Orthodox, they are being maligned as untrustworthy by the official Orthodox. And so if you're a private householder, a member of the laity, you don't really care. You just go to your synagogue and that's it. But if you're a moel, a shochet, a rabbi, a chazan, a malamed, you're earning your paycheck from the kehillah, and that kehillah is a status quo kehillah, all of a sudden you are now persona non grata to the Orthodox. And what happens if your religious scruples tell you that you have to listen to the Gedolim, to Maram Shik, and to Chaim Sofer, and to the others? Then do you have to give up your job and give up your livelihood? Because the great rabbis say you must? So there are in the responsa literature, you have the Shilas HaTshuvas, where the big rabbis oftentimes give a hard answer. They give a tough, uncompromising answer that you cannot work for those kehilot. You have to give up your parnasa. That's a disaster for a lot of people. In America, you have the same thing. You have, can you work at a conservative shul? Rav Moshe answered that question many times in the Igros Moshe. All right. So, the other consideration we have to think about is, was this schism real or imaginary? So certainly at the administrative level, it's real. And certainly for those who earn a parnasa from being a Jewish functionary and you might lose your livelihood, it's very real for you and your children. There's bread on the table. But more broadly speaking, does Judaism become two different religions? Orthodox and Neolog?
Was there mixed marriages?
So that's the big question. Socially, did they interact? Did they intermarry? And did they regard themselves klape chutz, vis-a-vis the outside world, as one religion? Certainly klape pnim, internally, there's this feud and we think of ourselves as two different groups. But to the outside world, are we one or not? So on the intermarriage issue, in the beginning, when social interactions were still quite common between the Orthodox and the Neologue, yes, there were intermarriages. And rabbis did not hesitate to officiate them. Why? Because they got paid. Okay. Later on, this would become a bit of a taboo, as the contact between the Neologue Jews and the Orthodox Jews became less and less. Now, it never became zero, because Jews still had the same economic profile and occupational profile, regardless of their denomination, and since you're going to be the same occupational profile as your Neologue buddy, even though you're an Orthodox Jew, so you're likely to be in business together, and you have to interact. So whereas you might not be chummy anymore and might not play cards together, and your son might not marry his daughter, still there's a relationship. Well, if there's a relationship, and a business one at that, you could ask a few interesting halachic questions. Can I, as an Orthodox Jew, have a business relationship with my Neologue partner and treat him as my Shabbos goy?
No.
Absolutely. So I bring this up because it's not just a theoretical question, it's a real question, and everybody in this room said, no, of course you couldn't do such a thing. Well, if we took at face value the more extreme pronouncements of the Chasam Sofer and the next generation or two of Hungarian Gedolim about, in the abstract, what is to happen to those who break away from doctrinal orthodoxy? Well, you're supposed to treat them as pitam paskusi, their bread is Gentile bread, v'yenam yayin nesach, and their wine is Gentile wine, okay? And you shouldn't intermarry with them. Well, does that make that person a goy, a Gentile? No. So we run up against, we hit a wall. We treat someone of the other variety negatively, in the sense that we cannot affirmatively recognize their Judaism, but we can also not deny it and say, well, if a guy, you know, drives on Shabbos, it's okay, or he runs my business on Saturday. No, that far you couldn't go, which means it's not two different religions, and these people are still Jewish. Okay, other factors. What about the seminary? Did the Orthodox rabbis try to block the creation of the Budapest Rabbinical Seminary? Well, after the schism of 1871, or 1869, and the establishment of a separatist Orthodox in 1871, you might think, well, we'll do our thing, we'll go to yeshiva, and you'll do your thing, you want to have a seminary, kol hakavod to you. We're not going to go there, but it's your thing. If they really were two different religions, like Protestant and Catholic, then the Orthodox should not have objected to the seminary. And yet, they did. Of course they did. Why? Because the bottom line is, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. And a Jew who's interested in being a rabbi, okay, are few and far between. And where are they going to go? The Pressburg Yeshiva? Some other yeshiva? Or the Budapest Seminary? Well, plenty of people who had gone to the yeshiva might then go to the seminary. Countless people who you know of went to yeshiva college and then took the subway to JTS 3080 Broadway. All right, it's not an uncommon thing for a person interested in being a member of the clergy to have a very traditional early education and then a more progressive later education. So that's why.
That plays itself in that.
Huh? So now it's not true. Now it's not true, except for my classmates who went to Chov Torah. All right. I don't say it disparagingly. I just say the reality is that certain members of my class of Yeshiva College, class of 2002, went across the river to Riverdale. Okay, so across the estuary. But
was there anything that modern Orthodoxy had here? And let's say you wouldn't
be,
you know, right next synagogue.
Yeah. There was a small neo-Orthodoxy in Hungary that kind of disappeared and was swallowed up by the other factions, the centrist Orthodox.
The ones that came here were not the little bit Orthodox. They were the real Hasidim.
Well, the ones who came 100 years, 90 years later.
90 years later.
the Hungarian Jews who came to America much earlier were traditional Jews who, for the most part, established Orthodox synagogues like OZ on the Upper West Side and hired Yasala Rosenblatt to daven for them. There were Hungarian synagogues in America that were basically moderate Orthodox synagogues, although there were some that ended up becoming conservative shuls. But these were not Hasidim, because Hasidim didn't move to America in the 1870s. Okay. So, with the few minutes we have left, the other consideration is Klapei Chutz. Did the Jews recognize themselves as one group to the outside world? Yes. There never was any doubt that if Judaism was going to be recognized as an accepted religion on par with Christianity, that it would be the totality of Judaism and not just a subgroup within Judaism. Meaning, there was never a chance that Orthodoxy, but not Neolog, or Neolog, but not Orthodoxy, was going to become an accepted religion. Never. Okay? It was always going to be all of Judaism or none of Judaism. Which means, we're one kehila. Yeah?
They never broke with, let's say, certain cardinal rules of
No.
Nothing.
So nothing of that sort.
They always kept the foundation. Shabbos was on Shabbos.
Yes.
There were
Neolog congregations that were more progressive than others,
right,
that allowed certain anti-halachic innovations, notably the organ.
Right.
I mean, of all the tinkering with the synagogue, the one that's clearly usher is the organ. You're not allowed to play a musical instrument on Shabbos. Now, why? Not for now, but you're not allowed to. And yet, there were places that they had it.
But the guy played it.
All right, so if the goy plays it, it makes it less bad. It doesn't make it kosher. Okay, so
that was the rationale.
That's the rationale, yeah.
They kept the same foundation.
Yes. Now, the important thing also is there's never discussion of theological points, you know, about revelation, the origins of the oral law, the origins of the Bible. None of that matters to these people. It's all about practical religion. So, in this respect, Neolog Judaism was not a danger to Orthodoxy in the long run outside of Hungary. It only was relevant in Hungary and eventually becomes, you know, the dominant force as assimilation takes over, and certainly after the Shoah, post-1945, Neolog becomes Hungarian Judaism, basically. There almost is nothing left, especially after 1956, when a lot of Hasidim leave. Yeah, Asher, you had a point.
Yeah, I'm taking all of this, and I revel, really, that in this part of the world, the state did not see the Jews as the other. Just a few hundred miles south, in the golden age of Salonika, Sephardic Jewry, in 1912, with the exchanges of population and territory with Turkey, etc., Salonika comes under the aegis of the Greek state, and the hero of Greece, the name of the airport in Athens today, Seleftherios Venizelos, intentionally wants to break up this cohesive unit called Judaism by mandating the opening of businesses on Shabbat and Hellenism. And
right.
Hellenization.
Right.
The intentional indoctrination of the Greek language and other things.
So the Magyars in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s did have an aggressive agenda to make the Jews more Magyar. However, that never rose to the level of coercing a Jew to violate their religious scruples. It was in the realm of language, in the realm of culture, but we don't find that the state wanted to subvert the halakha, so to speak. That never happened, and in fact, the Hungarian state, as we look at it in hindsight, did a tremendous amount of good to perpetuate orthodoxy by allowing communal orthodoxy to thrive. Now, the fact that the bottom line is orthodoxy declines in raw numbers is just because that's the way of the world in post-Enlightenment times. But it wasn't the state's fault. It was just the way of the world. Okay, so we'll stop here.